and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and welcome back to another edition of Ron Fuller's Studcast. I'm the great Ryan Last. It's my pleasure to be with you once again as the Tennessee Stud takes us down that road of wrestling history. And today, a very special road. We're going to focus on one of the all-time greats in wrestling history. And to tell you more about that, the man of the hour, the host of the Studcast, the legendary Tennessee Stud himself, Ron Fuller. Ron, how are you?
I'm great. Great, Brian. And, we're going to do something a little different today. And, I was prepared today to continue the normal progression of the Studcast. But someone died this past Thursday on August 1st, 2019, that was very special to me and hundreds of other wrestlers at the same time and fans all around the world. The incomparable Harley Race was finally defeated for the last time by lung cancer. And I feel compelled to honor one of the greatest wrestlers of all time, 8-time NWA world champion Harley Race. Not because of his being world champion, so much as because of who he was as a man and what he overcame in his lifetime and what he accomplished in his lifetime. In my opinion, there was never an NWA champion like him or any other champion from any other wrestling company on the face of the earth either. I could spend hours discussing this man, but I was lucky enough to wrestle him 10 times in my career. 9 of those were world championship matches, and one of them was a Texas death match. And they were all had special memories for me. So today I would like to just for us to dive into the life of Harley Race. And I know this is probably happening in podcasts all around the world. And it's because of who he was and the greatness that he possessed. And I want fans to know, if they don't know a lot about Harley, just some of his history. We're going to talk about these 10 matches during this program today. And right now, first, let's get some Harley history right off the bat. Jump in anytime you want to in here, Brian, during the course of this one today. Let me start with a special tribute. This is a special tribute show, obviously, and with some facts about Harley, who, in my opinion, was one of the toughest humans to ever walk on the face of the earth. I spent some time on many Studcasts telling short stories about Harley. In fact, the last half of Studcast number 74, if anyone out listening out there has not heard it, is all about Harley from the break on to the end of that program. And I will try not to touch on too much of what I already said during that episode, but focus on the 10 unforgettable matches I had with him from 1973 to 1980. First, though, I want to briefly cover what Harley Race told me over the years that we were friends. The few times, and it was way too few times, that I had a chance to sit down and really talk to Harley about his life and what he was able to defeat in his early years, beginning as a small boy. Let's go back to his born in Quitman, Missouri on April 11th, 1943, and he was the son of a sharecropper. That's not a lot of money in that. That's a very, very bad place to be. And my dad owned big farms, and we had sharecroppers on those farms. And I felt bad when he told me that alone. It really stuck in my mind. As a child, he came down with polio, which was a nightmare of a disease back in those days. Franklin Roosevelt, a former president, suffered from the same disease through much of his life. And for our younger audience out there that don't remember or don't even know much about that disease, I can remember seeing photos of young children in these test tube looking body chambers back in the 1950s suffering and dying from this disease. It killed or crippled many Americans before a cure was finally discovered. After his victory over polio, that was an amazing feat right there. He was diagnosed later as a child with cancer, and he beat that disease as well and became healthier and bigger than most kids his age by the time he got to high school. And Harley tells me these stories himself. And about the age of 16, he says he got into a fight with an older boy in the high school that he was going. I guess he's probably in his first or second year in high school. And he had the guy down and out, you know, and as he would do many times in the future with wrestlers in his chosen profession. And his high school principal saw the fight. And he tried to pull Harley off, and he ended up kneeing him in the back of the head to stop him from further injuring the student. And in true Harley fashion, Race turned around and turned his attention on the principal, and then had his principal down and was kicking the hell out of him. So obviously he got thrown out of high school at an early age. And, you know, you're in a little town like Quitman, Missouri. There's not a lot of high schools there, not a lot of the opportunities for you. So with no school in his future, he turned to two wrestlers that happened to own a farm that his family worked on as sharecroppers. And they were famous shooters at that time, the Sabisco brothers, Stanless and Waldeck. They took a liking to Harley, and they trained him enough to turn him over to Gus Karras, the wrestling promoter, the local wrestling promoter in St. Joseph, Missouri. Harley began not in the ring, but as a driver for 800-pound wrestler Happy Humphrey at 17 years of age. He's involved in wrestling, professional wrestling, at 17 years old, driving around an 800-pound big old fat wrestler. And by 18 years of age, he was in the ring working with grown men every night. And knowing Harley as I did, he was making a very big impression on those guys, even at 18 years old. After leaving there, Harley went oddly enough to Nashville, Tennessee to work for my grandfather, Roy. When he told me that, I almost fell out of my chair. I was like, wow, I never thought he would have wrestled for Roy. He told me he was particularly impressed with Roy's brother, Herb, the world junior heavyweight champion. He met and he married his first wife in Nashville. And when they left Tennessee soon thereafter, she was 6 weeks pregnant. They were going back home to St. Joseph, Missouri. He had spent some time in the Tennessee territory, and he felt like he was ready to go home and see if he could move up and work himself into a better spot there. And he wanted to continue his wrestling career in his home area. I don't blame him for that. And on that trip home, the two of them, him and his wife, had a horrible car wreck. And both he and his wife were declared dead at the scene. When he told me that, I was like, wait a minute. Were you dead? He wanted to tell me the whole story. So he continued with the story. So again, he had cheated death because they had him in an ambulance because they came in an ambulance to take him to the hospital. Then they thought they were dead. So they put him in the ambulance to take him to the morgue, and they saw him move. Somebody saw his body in the back move, and they took him to the hospital. So the first thing they did was they put a steel rod in his arm. He's unconscious. He's unconscious for 4 days. And so they worked on his arm, but he had horrible problems with both his legs. One of them was bad enough. They were going to take it off. They were going to remove it, but they were waiting for him to regain consciousness before they did that. And someone luckily had notified this local promoter, Gus Karras, that about the accident and where Harley was in the hospital. And Karras arrived at the hospital just in time. The surgeons had Harley on the cart, and they were about to roll him in and remove his leg. And Karras said, "Absolutely not. You can't take this guy's leg off." And they said, "No, he'll never walk again, and he's never going to be able to use it." And Karras just really, you know, he said, "You against my life, he'll take his leg." You know, he really stood up and he saved Harley's leg, not just his leg, but he saved his career right there at that time. But being Harley, there was no stopping him. And after they told him when he came out of surgery that he says, "How long before I can wrestle?" And they said, "You'll never wrestle again. You'll never walk again." And knowing Harley and the way he was, in less than 2 years, he was not only walking, but he was back in the ring again. So it was just a great example of the heart of this phenomenal man, Harley Race. I don't have near enough time in this studcast to cover all the other stories about Harley, and there are literally hundreds of them. I want to spend the rest of this special tribute to Harley talking about those 10 matches that I had with him and how lucky I was to have that opportunity against one of the greatest wrestlers of all time.
Ron, when was your first match with Harley Race?
Well, my first match with Harley Race was on May 30th, 1973. And it's a world championship match. I had never seen Harley Race wrestle. I'll be honest with you, I did not even know the name. I'd briefly heard of him maybe on a couple of occasions, but it was in Miami. This first match where I went to college years earlier, and it was my third year as a pro. Harley was not champion. You know, Harley was just become champion, and they brought him into Florida, and they didn't want to put him on with a top guy. I was toward the top of the card, and I was the logical guy to give him a good win in the middle. And he, at this point, was not a big star in Florida. I don't know that he'd ever been to Florida many times at this point in his career. In fact, this might have been the first trip for him to Florida. And when the powers that be in the NWA office in St. Louis were thinking and planning to switch of the title to someone that was not over in a particular territory, the NWA would send that uncrowned champion a lot of times into those territories to get them over before they became champion. They had not, I don't think, sent Harley in there to get over before he became champion. They sent him in there, and I'm wrestling one of his first trips ever to Florida, I think. And he's about to make quite an impression on Florida fans his first week there. He came in for an entire week. I got him on a Wednesday night in Miami. My biggest memory of this first match with Harley is all based upon the finish. Obviously, I was going over because he would soon be the NWA world champion. He is the NWA world champion at this point. And I was still very green, as we called it in the business, meaning I was young and inexperienced. My job was to get him over, and it was all based upon his unique finish that I had never seen. The referee that night delivered the finish to me and said that Harley would headbutt me off the top rope for the finish. I'd never seen his move, and I was confused by the ref's simple explanation, and after discussing it further with the referee, I sent him back. He got confused too. And he says, "Well, Ron, I really don't know what that was. I thought you'd know." So I go back and ask him what he's talking about doing. So the referee goes back to Harley's dressing room and he comes back to me and he says that, he means, Ron, that, he wants to set you up in the middle of the ring, and he's going to climb up on the top rope, and he's going to dive off the top rope with his head into the side of your head. And when he told me that, I wished I hadn't asked him to go back. You know, it's like, "Oh, wait a minute." I was like, this is going to kill either me or him. So, it sounded dangerous for both of us. And I went into the ring very apprehensive, obviously, about the move that was going to finish this match. And when it came time, Harley suplexed me in the middle of the ring. And then he stepped through the ropes, climbed to the top rope, And he stood there, very erect and straight. And then he came diving head first, clamped his arms to his side. He looked like a torpedo in the air, and his head was coming right toward mine. Yeah, most wrestlers in these type of moves close their eyes. Or moves like this sometimes will keep themselves, if they close their eyes, it keeps them from moving and possibly making a guy's finish look bad. But I wanted to watch this move all the way from the top rope to the connection between his head and mine. It usually made me more comfortable to watch a potential incoming disaster. But in this case, when I watched it halfway down, I couldn't keep my eyes open and watch. About halfway down, it appeared he was going to slam his head in the side of my head. I had to close my eyes at the last second to prevent myself from moving. He planted his head between my head and shoulder so softly I could hardly feel the contact. I knew in that instant why he was the new world champion. There was no doubt about it.
Well, you know, Ron, the reason he didn't go around to the different territories like so many others had, like Jack Briscoe had been doing, was he originally wasn't the planned NWA champion. It was going to go from Dory Funk Jr. to Jack Briscoe. Dory Funk Jr. allegedly had a tractor accident on his father's ranch, hurt himself, and then he eventually lost the title to Harley Race, and it was Harley Race that lost it to Jack Briscoe.
Yeah, makes sense, you know, and they put it on the right guy. You know, transition wasn't smooth like it should have been from the Funks to the Briscoes, but sometimes things don't work out in wrestling like they always should. Let's talk a little bit about the second match with Harley. It was 7 months later on January 18th, 1974 in St. Louis, his home state. This time he was champion again. You know, he's champion every time, but in all these matches except for one, I had a Texas death match with him. We were both stars in this town. I had been making St. Louis for a year and a half, and I had seen him there several times during the course of that. But this night, I was wrestling him for the world championship in St. Louis on the top of the card. And he'd always been a heel there. But because he was now the NWA world champion on that night, the fans seemed to like him more. And I think it was maybe even out of respect for the fact that he's now the world champion. It was the first of six 60-minute time limit draws that Harley and I would have in four different states over the next 7 years. We had a lot of broadways. We spent a lot of time in the ring together. We really got to know each other well in the ring itself. What I remember about this match is a strange thing. It was the middle of winter in St. Louis and very cold. Not only outside the building, but inside as well. When they closed these building downs and they weren't running them every night, they got very cold inside. They didn't run the heat. And they probably turned the heat on in the afternoon in Kiel Auditorium, and it did not warm up that building like it should have. Because I lived and worked mostly in Florida, where the temperatures were about 70 degrees or warmer even at night, and in Missouri at that time of year, you know, that's probably 70 degrees colder than what I'm used to breathing into when I'm in the ring in Florida. And my lungs were used to warm air. But spending, and people probably don't realize this, but by spending every other weekend in St. Louis where buildings were full of the cold air, my lungs were slow to adjust to this huge temperature change. We did a Broadway. We did an hour that night. And I remember just sucking wind so badly toward the end of it because Harley was hard to keep up with. And it made it really painful for me to breathe. But that 60 minutes of pain in my lungs was absolutely horrible, especially past the 45-minute mark. The last 5 minutes of a one-hour Broadway match in which you're going to go the time limit was critical to every Broadway. To give the fans what they wanted, the last 5 minutes required you to expend as much effort as you had in the entire 55 minutes leading up to it. I thought my lungs were going to burst that night. I was not able to breathe normally until I got back to Florida 2 days later after I'd worked the St. Louis TV on Sunday. It was really, really a difficult to experience wrestling in that cold ass building. And it happened to me almost every time I went north because I was so accustomed to that warm air.
You know, one of the things that's amazing about Harley being able to go and have all these broadways to have that stamina is here's a guy who was a chain smoker, who enjoyed a beer. He wasn't Mr. Fitness. Meanwhile, he actually was, because he was able to do these 60-minute matches frequently while, you know, not necessarily getting on the treadmill every day.
Yeah, he was phenomenal. It wasn't, you know, in Harley's case, it wasn't just his lungs. It was the heart. Harley had such a huge heart. And that's, I think, what made him different than most every other wrestler that guys have opportunity to wrestle. My third match with Harley was more than 3 years later in Knoxville on April 28, 1977. This was our first time to work there, and another 60-minute Broadway title match. This one is memorable for two things: the size of the crowd and my payoff to Harley. We had now been wrestling weekly in that Coliseum for more than a year, and crowds had been growing all that time. That night, we broke the all-time record for attendance in the Coliseum for any sports event, and that record still stands 42 years later. There's never been a bigger event, sporting event, in that Coliseum than me and Harley raced for the world title in 77. The fire marshal, somehow, that night, the only reason it happened is I guess the fire marshal somehow allowed thousands more in the building than it was supposed to hold. I don't think the fire marshal showed up, to be honest with you, because I'm serious. The aisles, when I looked up that night into the aisles, it was a sea of humanity. They had no seats to sit in the upper two balconies, and they end up sitting in the aisles. And it was an unbelievable sight. And it was like that throughout the building. And I was told by many fans that there was more people outside the building that got turned away than got into the building. So I have no idea how many came that night to see that match. But what was inside the building was an all-time record. And there were thousands that could not get in. Obviously, it was a big payoff for Harley, and I paid him myself with $100 bills that night. I counted them out for him in his hand, and I watched his eyes as I piled them up. I got into a habit of doing that, and I didn't pay all guys in cash, but he was the champion. It was his first time in Knoxville. It was a fabulous and fantastic crowd. It was a fantastic match as well. And when I placed the last of that $2,000 payoff in his hand, he looked up at me and he said, Ron, you can call Sam Muchnick tomorrow and tell him I said to book me in this town as often as he can. like I said, the match was phenomenal, and hundreds of people over the next couple of years would stop me on the streets and say, you and Harley Race had the greatest wrestling match I ever saw in my life. Maybe because there were so many people in the building, they couldn't see well, but some of the boys watching said the crowd never sat down for the entire match, the entire hour. It was what wrestling was all about back in its heyday in those 70s.
Ron, you talked about how Harley mentioned you calling Sam Muchnick. How did you actually go about booking Harley? Did you call Sam?
Yes, I did. In fact, when he said that, I was really flabbergasted. I was surprised. I figured that everybody paid him really, really well, and he seemed to be surprised by how much the payoff was. And so I didn't hesitate. I called Sam Muchnick the very next morning, and said that Harley wanted to work there as much as possible, and by golly, it worked. The fourth Harley match was less than a month after that match. So, Sam says, Ron, you really want him? I got a Friday night and it's 4 weeks away. I said, give him to me. Heck yes, I want him. So this crowd was slightly smaller than the first one, but only because the fire marshal probably the one that didn't show up got his ass chewed so bad that they clamped down that night on the number of tickets that they allowed to sell, and again turned away thousands and thousands of people. This match was memorable to me because of what happened in the match. After the 60-minute time limit draw, and it was another 60-minute time limit draw, I body slammed Harley early in the match, and he told me, as soon as I got him up, I think he called for a high spot, one tackle, a leapfrog, a body slam, arm drag. And I get the arm drag, and he tells me, he says, "God, I love this ring. I love the sound." You know, and I love the way Harley took a body slam. You know, and he took a body slam different than all wrestlers. And when most wrestlers, that you got up to my shoulder height, and when you pick up somebody, slam them, you lift them up at least to shoulder height. And that's pretty high for a guy as tall as I am. It's higher than they're accustomed to, most guys. And most guys weren't real happy with that body slam. Harley loved it. So when you got up to that height with Harley, he would stiffen up his body and straighten his body out. And I would actually got to where during this match that I could actually jump into the air with him at shoulder height to get 6 inches higher off the mat, 6 inches to a foot, and slam him in the process, turn him loose from up there as high as I could get. My 20-foot square Knoxville ring was so good, and it sounded so great. Harley must have taken 30 body slams in that match that night. And it was an hour, too, as well. Every high spot off the ropes ended up in a body slam. And as the night went on, Harley began to sell his back from all those body slams. And the crowd realized he was such a great seller that they realized that he's going to beat Harley Race by slamming him. Harley's back is going. And the last 5 minutes, there wasn't anyone sitting in that building as Harley barely kicked out of body slam after body slam again and again. Once I realized that he had sold it so good to the fans, I stuck with it. And he just pushed me toward it. He just said, "Ron, keep it coming. Another slam, another slam." And then on the last 5 minutes, he started kicking out. When the referee's hand was coming down for the three count, I thought I was going to be world champion accidentally. You know, I mean, he was just pushing it to the extreme, but he was blowing those fans' minds. Not many wrestlers could, or more importantly, would sell like that. It was another beautiful Broadway, an example of Harley's ability to change his style every single match.
Well, Ron, we will return to your tribute to Harley Race in just a moment. But first, let's go to this word about the latest Super Studcast. Of course, Super Studcast number 19, part 1 and 2 with Dirty Dutch Mantel, as well as the next Super Studcast. Here, who's going to be on that right now.
Wrestlers are renowned worldwide for being characters. Down and Dirty Dutch Mantel fits perfectly into that mold. At TNStud.com or Patreon.com/Studcast. The Tennessee Stud also fits that mold. Put them together with 3 hours plus to tell stories and relive history, and you have another record-setting Super Studcast that will blow your mind. And if Dutch isn't enough, the next Super Studcast, number 20, will be released on Tuesday, August 13th, and it will feature another great character, the Universal Heartthrob, Austin Idol, at TNStud.com or Patreon.com/Studcast. Only $2.99 for 3 tremendous hours of old school history. The Stud keeps roping the stars as Super Studcast continue to thrill fans around the world. So, saddle up!
There you hear it, Super Studcast number 19, the Down and Dirty Edition with Dutch Mantel, parts 1 and 2, over 3 hours of great wrestling talk, available right now. And the next Super Studcast number 20, which will be released on Tuesday, August 13th, with none other than the Universal Heartthrob, Austin Idol. This is definitely a can't-miss episode. Check it out today. Get ready for the next one at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast for only $2.99. You get in the door. It's the best deal in wrestling. But Ron, let's return to your list. What is the fifth match you had with Harley Race?
Okay, the fifth match takes place almost 1 year exactly after the last one we talked about before the break. It was in Knoxville again on May the 3rd, 1978, about 1 year exactly since I'd worked with him there. And it was the third 60-minute time limit Broadway in a row. This one is memorable for the crowd attendance and for what happened before the match started. Business was fantastic in 1978 and for Southeastern, and the Coliseum was just not large enough for these world title matches. Biggest building in town at that point. There was no place I could go that was bigger. And in anticipation of another sellout, I worked with the Coliseum management to add ringside seats on the floor because you couldn't add any seats upstairs. They're all permanent, but you could add temporary seats like ringside seating to provide more actual seats in the building than ever before. We drew the second largest crowd for a sports event ever in that building. So not only did we hold the record for the biggest, we held the number one and two records were both me and Harley Race wrestling. It was only eclipsed by that first world title match with Harley when the fire marshal allowed us to oversell the capacity. Thousands were turned away again, as with all three of these matches. And the second thing that night that's memorable, that it hurts me to think about it. Harley and I were both in the ring about to be introduced when Ron Wright comes down to the ring and gets the microphone away from Phil Rainey, who was the ring announcer in the Coliseum. He starts bitching about his stomper, who he was managing at the time, not getting this title shot with Harley Race rather than me getting it. So he just continues in one of his Ron Wright rants, just as usual, until I get out of the ring and I go down there to basically chase him away. Well, he doesn't leave right away. So what am I to do? So I knock him around a little bit, and the crowd loves it. You know, he's out there running his mouth. And so I get to whip a little bit of Ron Wright's ass before I get in the ring with Harley. And he's wearing, for some reason that night, a suit and tie. And I'd never seen him with a suit and tie on. So I nail him with a couple of shots, and then I grab the collar of his shirt, and I'm going to tear his shirt off. And I intended to get my whole hand inside his shirt collar, but it was too tight. So only the big finger on my right hand went inside his collar. And when I jerked my hand down to rip his shirt, the shirt didn't go, but my finger did. I broke my finger at the knuckle, and it bent sideways, perpendicular to the other fingers on my hand.
Oh.
And so it bent like a 90-degree angle across the other two fingers. So I reached and grabbed it, and I pulled it back in place as good as I could, but it was broken, and I could not move it much. It didn't flex, and it didn't bend like it had before I broke it. So I just tucked it into my palm, and I got back in the ring to work. And Harley was very observant. And when I did this, nobody really saw it. You know, that's what I figured, everybody noticed it, but nobody saw it. So, but Harley, being observant like he was and an old pro, He saw it. And when they introduced us and we went to the center of the ring to get the referee's instructions at the beginning of the match, he says to me, "You broke your finger, didn't you?" And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Are we still going Broadway?" I don't think he thought I'd be able to do it, you know. And I said, "Absolutely." And we worked that 1 hour Broadway with my broken finger tucked into my palm. And even the referee, Mac, didn't even see it himself. It was probably, for me, the longest Broadway I ever had or would have, because it was very, very difficult to wrestle an hour with a guy like Harley and to have a broken finger that you had just broken to 20 seconds prior to the match beginning. So very difficult match, the fifth one.
So for those of us who have never broken a finger, what do you do after you get back? First of all, it's amazing you did a Broadway after that. But after you get back and your finger is still broken and it's going the wrong direction, what do you do?
Well, you know, I broke it again. I re-broke it again. I got it straightened out a little bit more. And I'm looking at it right now. It's still got that little bend to the right in it. I did not ever get it set. I never went and got it set. I never went and got anything that I got hurt on very often taken care of. So, you know, if I had problems with knees, I had problems with knees for years. This finger never seemed to bother me. It bothered me for probably 3 months. And I remember I was at this point wrestling just opened up in Mobile, the Southeastern Southern Division. And I taped that finger to the two fingers next to it for 3 months, because if I left it out there on its own, I was going to have a lot of pain from it and I was likely to break it again. So I taped the three fingers together, and fans never knew why. But that was how I cured my finger. I never said it. Yeah. Not very smart, but that's what happened, needless to say.
Well, it seems like it worked, but let's get back to these matches with Harley. What's the sixth match?
The sixth one is, again, almost a year later than this one we just talked about, on May 18th, 1979, and is again in Knoxville. This one is memorable for selling out without the champion defending his title. Now, then you got to really listen to that. It was not a world championship match, and it was also memorable for the most remarkable bump at the end of the match that I ever saw in all of my wrestling career. This time, Sam Muchnick had given me 2 weeks back to back with Harley. Harley said, "I want to work in Knoxville," and Sam took him at his word. And Sam had two Friday nights back to back. And he says, "Ron, you want both of them?" I said, "Absolutely." And then I got to thinking about it. We had already had three Broadways in a row, and all three were sellouts. But this is a year later after those three sellouts. I knew we could sell out again. Well, what do you do with that second week? You know, you have the World Championship. Well, what are you going to do with the second week? So somebody needed to win that night, you know, and how do you do that was my question as a booker and as an owner of a company, you know, and it was not a championship match, and it still sold out. And what I decided to do is I made it a Texas death match between me and the world champion, which was a tremendous idea. And in hindsight, it was probably the best thing I could have done. I had Harley cut these interviews for the next week. We're coming right back the next week. And he cut interviews and sent them in saying that if I lost the Texas death match to him, I would never get to wrestle him again for the world championship. So I added, in my interview on the television program, I said, "Well, I've got a stipulation I'm going to add to the match. If I win this Texas death match, then I would automatically get the world title match the next Friday night." So obviously, this match was absolutely off the charts. I mean, we did stuff that we had never done in those world championship matches, a double blood and a whole lot of it. It was Harley's type of match, and just about as long as a Broadway Texas death match rule. It was almost as long as an hour Broadway, this Texas death match. Falls don't count in these matches, and you have a 30-second break after each fall, and the first man that can't get to his feet after that 30-second break and the referee counting to 10 loses the match. So I think this might have been the best match I ever had with Harley. He got me bleeding first, and he took a lot of falls off the start of it. For probably 30 minutes, he took every fall. And then I finally started coming back, and then I got him bleeding. And then I took 30 falls. You know, I mean, toward the end, then he stopped me. He set me up, and he got me with his headbutt off the top rope. Crowd had never seen that move. There was a gasp when his head hit my head in the middle of the ring. People knew that was it. I mean, it was like a groan and a gasp from 8,000-10,000 people. I don't know exactly what we had there that night. Everyone in the building thought it was over, but I managed to get to my feet after the 30-second break, and I got to my feet on the 9 count. So he just snatched me up and he suplexed me, and he drug me out on the announcer's table next to the ring. He stood up on the table. He reached down and picked me up, and he body slammed me on that table with him standing on the table at the same time. Then he took my head and he drug my body down to where my legs were hanging off the end of it, and he placed my head in the middle of the table. And then he went up on the top rope again, right above me, as I lay right there on that table right next to the ring. He just hit me with the big dive off the top rope in the middle, and he made it look like, by God, this, here comes the coup de grace. And when he dived off that top rope for my head in the middle of the table, I rolled off the table to the concrete floor, and he went head first through that table, and that table snapped in half. You couldn't see any of his upper body that was trapped inside the broken table, and all that was visible was his legs sticking straight up in the air. It was an unbelievable sight. When he took that bump, I never heard a crowd pop like that. It was unbelievable. I rolled into the ring. The ref counted him out. He rang the bell for the 30 seconds to start. At the end of the 30 seconds, he counted him out to 10. He rung the bell, and he raised my hand. And then they had to come and help me. We had worked a long, grueling match. We were both bloody down to our boots. And my brother came, Jimmy came, baby faces came down, and they watched it all. You know, I didn't say, come get me. They watched it, and they knew that, God, man, he's going to need help to even get back here. And even worse, when they got me out of the ring and they started helping me back to the dressing room, I turned around and looked, and Harley's feet were still sticking straight up in the air. He was still head first in that table. Fans still talk about that finish today. When I go to Knoxville and I'm down around town, people see me. They either want to talk about that first world title match, or they want to talk about that bump that he took in the Texas Death Match. I think we may be getting close to the end here. You know, we've got a limited time here because it's a normal studcast, and I'd like to keep it within the time frame or close to it if possible. So I'll try to be a little shorter with these last four Harley matches. The seventh one was a week after the Texas Death Match. This was for the title. That was the deal. If I beat him, I get to wrestle him for the title. It was on May the 25th, 1979, and another sellout. This was the only time that we had any type of disqualification in the championship match, and this one was a double disqualification. We both were bleeding again, as we were the week before, but we got into such a brawl that the wrestlers had to actually come to the ring from the dressing room and pull us apart. It was almost as exciting as the Texas Death Match the week before. It was the last NWA world title match that Southeastern Wrestling ever presented in Knoxville. Future matches with Harley are going to all take place in Southeastern Wrestling in the Pensacola territory. So there was the end of the world title matches, the last one, and it was pretty darn spectacular too, I felt, and really something extremely memorable for me. The eighth match was on June the 10th, 1979. Now we're in Pensacola, in a territory based in Pensacola rather than Knoxville. It's less than a month after this one than Knoxville. This city was one of the best small cities in all of wrestling, Dothan, Alabama. 75,000 people. Sometimes you put 7,000, 10% of the population in the building. It was unbelievable wrestling town. The building there was a steel roof building with a dirt floor, no air conditioning, no windows, and people allowed to smoke. And notice, this is June the 10th in 1979. The temperature that day was in the 90s, and the sun beat down on that steel roof all day long. It was well over 100 degrees in the building when I walked in about 30 minutes before the first match. You might guess what I remember most about this one, and obviously, and it was another 60-minute time limit. Obviously, it's the heat. There was probably 6,000 people in the building that night, and it was built for a maximum of 4,000. There was people standing on both ends of the building, shoulder to shoulder, side by side, in probably masses of 1,000 people on each side behind ringside, on each side of the building. It was an unbelievable crowd. And we were truly trying to build Southeastern in that part of the country. I wanted to give the fans something special to remember. So I doubt they'd ever seen a 60-minute time limit draw with a world champion. So Charlie Platt and Gordon Solie were my commentators at that time for Southeastern Wrestling. And Charlie Platt lived in Dothan and had been born and raised there. So I had him go over and talk to Harley about the finish. And I asked him to go over to the other dress room and tell Harley we're going to go Broadway. I also told Charlie, who was the timekeeper for the match, to take off about 10 minutes of that hour if he could. Because I'm anticipating, man, it's over 100 degrees and we're going out there. There people are smoking in the building. You couldn't see from one side of the building the other for the smoke that was in the air. So I said, Charlie, take 10 minutes off of that. So he was a little suspect about it. And when he went and told Harley we were going there, he also told Harley that I told him to subtract about 10 minutes from that hour. Charlie told me this many years later. He didn't tell me that night. It was many years later what Harley said after he said subtract 10 minutes. After he said, I told him to subtract 10 minutes from the match, he said, Harley said to him, if you take off 1 second, Charlie, of that hour, I will come out of that ring and kick your ass. So, that kind of says everything about the man Harley Race was. I lost 19 pounds in that hour. And you probably say, how do I know? Well, I know because there was a scales in that room. And I weighed myself going out, and I weighed myself when I came through the door coming back. And I had lost 19 pounds in that 1 hour. And I felt bad about how I felt. But Harley worked that night with broken ribs. So, you know, gosh almighty, what a man. I mean, it's just unbelievable what he could do.
When was the next time you brought him into the Pensacola territory?
He came in Montgomery, October 6, 1980. It was for a world title match again. He was in Southeastern Pensacola for a rare full week that week. And I had two of those nights in the ring with him. We had a great crew of babyfaces at that time. And the territory was on fire, but it was just still growing. I thought we couldn't get any bigger, but we were going places. We were really cranked at that point. Harley probably worked also that same week with Bob Armstrong, Joe LaDuke, Ken Lucas, my brother Robert, Jimmy Golden. I mean, that's a pretty good troop of baby faces there. The Montgomery match was a rare one, in fact in which he beat me right in the middle of the ring. And I had him use a foreign object to do it. And I remember this one not because of the match, but what happened immediately following the match. Montgomery was the most difficult town in Southeastern out of Pensacola to draw crowds in. And all the larger cities, it was the worst of all the larger cities that we had matches in. It was beginning to grow, but I thought it needed a shot in the arm, and Harley stealing this one from me was just what the doctor ordered. It was a record crowd that night, the Montgomery Civic Center. We finally sold that building out. And for us at that time, we did it many times afterward. And that time, real heat was the answer for continuing that city's growth. It was a perfect finish. You could usually gauge a town's potential based upon having problems with rowdy fans. The more problems with people in the stands translated into more money in the box office. And on this night, Harley lit them up. I knew the finish would be hot, and so did old Harley, and old Harley loved it. As we did the finish, I could tell he might have a problem on the way to the dressing room. Because of the finish, I had to lay there and watch because of the way he had beat me. And he beat me with the headbutt off the top and his gimmick. Cracked me with the gimmick and then headbutted me off the top. And as best I could, I'm laying in a face down position. I see him crawl out of the ring and trying to head to the dressing room. And he grabbed the 10 pounds of gold, and here he went. after the match was over. And now, policemen at the matches were critical to crowd control. The best cops saw things developing, and they learned how to stop them before they happened. It took training from the wrestlers and the cooperation from the police in every town for that to happen. And the police in Montgomery were just hard to train. They wanted to stand back and watch the matches as the fans did. And that could only lead to something bad happening. And on this night, it's going to. So as Hardy steps through the ropes and down on the floor, two guys start rushing at him as best I can see. Now, I'm trying to sell, but I want to see how Harley handles this. And there's a small mob of fans following right on the tail end of those two guys. There's not a policeman anywhere in sight. They should have been there, but there's none there. So they could have prevented it from happening if they'd paid attention to the finish. But it was a hot finish, and the crowd was just explosive at that point. Harley saw the two guys coming, and he set the belt down on the ring apron. And I'm sure he also noticed that the police were nowhere in sight. Both guys were shoulder to shoulder, and they stepped over. We had a small rope. Back in those days, you didn't have the big barricade. There was a little small rope with some stanchions there, and it was placed there so that you would know, the fan would know, that you're stepping into an area where you shouldn't be. You know, you're too close to the ring. So these two guys just step over the rope. Harley just waited patiently for them to make their move. The closest one to him, I watched. Now I rolled on my side so I could see it. The closest one to him took a swing at Harley. And like lightning, man, he ducked out of the punch. And he hit the guy with the punch with his right hand. I mean, he just ducked it. Bam! Down he went. And instantly, he followed that up by knocking the one out with his left hand on the side beside him. It was like, bam, bam. I mean, I was still trying to sell, but what he had done to me, but I really wanted to watch him, you know? And about all I could tell was there was two guys coming at him, and suddenly they both disappeared in the blink of an eye. The police were still not in sight as Harley faced off the mob that was behind him, behind the two guys. But by gosh, the mob stopped. I mean, they saw that bam, bam, down, down. Two of them out, dead in the floor. And then he just calmly reached around. He picked up the belt, and he strolled back to the dressing room as if he was taking a walk in the park. I mean, it was like, and the policeman working the match finally showed up at ringside, and they walked straight past Harley and went to the two guys laying unconscious on the concrete where Harley had left him. Harley didn't need any protection at that point because he'd already convinced everyone in that damn building that he isn't somebody you want to mess with. And after years of hearing about Harley's badass attitude and fighting ability, I thankfully got my opportunity to see it for myself.
Well, Ron, that's 9 matches. You said we're going to talk about 10. What is the 10th match with you and Harley?
10th match is 6 days later. It's that week that he comes in and spends the whole week, 1980, and I work with him again on the last night he's there. It was in the territory's home of Pensacola, and it's on October 12th of 1980. It was the only 60-minute time limit Broadway Harley did all week, and I'm sure he was happy about that. You know, it was really difficult for war champions to do those hours night after night. So I only did that one with him on the last because we worked the Pensacola Auditorium that night. And it was right on the beautiful Pensacola Bay. It's a beautiful old building, a lot of history. Wrestlers dressed in the back area of the arena behind a giant curtain. They could get together and not be seen by the crowd. It was one of the few buildings in the territory where that could happen. We worked 7 nights a week in Pensacola, Southeastern Territory, and the town ran it on Sunday night, Pensacola. It was payday on Sunday nights, and the boys were always in a good mood. Harley being there made everybody even happier, and it was like a party backstage. That was not uncommon for my territories, but very uncommon in most territories. Harley noticed it right away, the difference in the raucous guys having a good time compared to other places. When we sat down to talk about the finish, which really was very very short and simple, we're going through, he said to me, he said, "Ron, this is unreal what you got going on here." He says, this may be the happiest territory I've ever seen. He goes, is it always like this? And I said, yeah, it is, Harley, you know. And then he said, I wish I could be in this crew and stay for a while. And obviously, I said, well, why don't you come back here and work some when you drop the strap? I mean, and he said, obviously, he would love to. So we had a tremendous one-hour Broadway before a record crowd, biggest in that building's history. I paid him after the match. And when we were the only two guys in the back, because it's an hour Broadway, and guys had seen lots of hour Broadways with me and Harley. So it sends up me and him at the very end of the night. I paid him for the entire 7 days. And as best I can remember, I gave him more than $10,000 in cash that night. He was blown away. He thanked me right there for all of the payoffs I had ever given him, which he didn't have to do. But he made a point of saying, man, you have paid me unreal. And it was to me right then as if he knew something that I didn't, like he was not going to be champion much longer. And that was the case, you know, but he's not inclined to tell me, and he had no reason to tell me. So I just wish I could have talked all night to Harley. It was the last time I ever saw Harley.
Well, Ron, before we wrap up this special tribute to Harley Race, are there any last thoughts you have about this all-time great, this NWA World Champion?
Well, I've kind of said it all in a way, you know, Brian, but he reminded me of my grandfather, not because of his age, but because of his toughness. I admired and respected Harley. I loved Harley Race. I loved Harley Race. He was everything a wrestler should be. His skills in the ring were legendary, but what he was capable of outside the ring was just as damn legendary. After he hung up his tights and left, there never was another Harley Race. And as long as this sport survives, there will never be another Harley Race.
Well, Ron, as we close this episode of the Studcast, we want to remind the listeners, you can become friends with Ron on Facebook, the page Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. You can follow the Tennessee Stud on Instagram and Twitter at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow me on Twitter at Great Brian Last. You can follow the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network on Twitter at Super Podcasts. And you can hear me on the 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com or available wherever it is that you find your favorite podcasts. Once again, we want to mention Super Studcast number 19, the Down and Dirty Edition with Dutch Mantel, is still breaking records. Check it out today. 3 hours plus of Dutch Mantel and the Tennessee Stud. It is available right now at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. And don't forget the next Super Studcast. I'm sure everyone's going to be talking about this one. Tuesday, August 13th. Part one of Super Studcast number 20 with the Universal Heartthrob, Austin Idol. This is a big one. Prepare for it today. Once again, tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Ron, where are we going next week?
Well, we're going to pick up where we left off last week. Harley's untimely demise, I felt necessary to us to stray a little bit from the normal format, because I wanted to do some type of tribute to Harley because he meant so much to me. We're going to go back next week to Memphis, Chattanooga, and Louisville. We're going to finish up for Jerry Jarrett in the summer of 1975. We're going to start digging some Indian artifacts in the state of Tennessee. We're going to review Southeastern cards, results, TV, and for the first time ever, payoffs for the first three-day weekend in Southeastern wrestling history on the next episode.
Ron Fuller's Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller, I'm the Great Brian Last. The story continues next week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So full Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.